We're prepared to start our program now. Before starting, I would like to introduce our program co-chairpersons. First, seated here, Professor Thomas Carr, I want to say Kerr, of Hastings, and the other co-chairman who will handle the introductions of our panel, David Dunn, now of Albany. David, if you'll take it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've had quite a bit of trouble putting together a program, and these people that we are going to listen to today, were asked to participate, and very nobly they came through. To my right, we have Mayor Freed of Northwestern, Randall Morrison of Hastings. To my left have Ed Schroeder of Florida State and Ray Marson of Catholic U. Ed will be the principal speaker in the sense that he will give the outline. It's kind of like going to be an overview. And I believe, does everybody have a copy of the topic? And the topic is quite a general one. It's approaches to the organization of courses in legal research and legal writing for first-year law students. As I said, Ed will give the overview and more or less state-of-the-art at the present time. The other three speakers will give detailed reports on how the programs are being conducted at their particular schools. This is an area, of course, as you probably realize, where not every program, no matter how good, it may be good for one school and not for another. It's something that you have to more or less tailor-made according to the needs of your own particular institution. However, it's good to know what the other fellow's doing at all times, particularly in an area such as this section pertains to, which we're a very new section. It's an area that has never been organized very much before. It's something that there's been very little communication as to what the various schools are doing. We are, of course, of necessity, a section which covers quite a narrow area of interest, unlike so many of the sections in the AALS. For this reason, I suppose we can expect a certain degree of repetition. Most of the programs, looking over the outlines I've seen, seem to have a fairly common pattern. I think, however, this is something, in view of the narrowness of our scope of interest, that cannot be avoided. After the speakers, Ed will be the first speaker. Then we will call him Mr. Marson, and then we'll call him Mr. Morrison and Mr. Freed. Does everybody agree to that order, or somebody want to go first? The thing is that I think the important thing is in a meeting like this is to communicate with one another and to come up with new ideas. So after the speakers are through, I suggest that we throw this meeting open to a general discussion and participation from the audience. Are there any suggestions that somebody thinks that this program that would improve on today's program? Very well, then.
Questions immediately after the speaker.
Be pardon?
Do we have questions immediately after the speaker presents the paper or thought?
Would everybody agree to that rather than waiting to the very end? I don't see any harm in it. Why not? I don't see any harm in that at all. although there, of course, of necessity, there will have to be some limitation in the time that you can question any individual speaker. Any other ideas? All right, then, I'll introduce Ed Schroeder of Florida State.
Almost 30 years ago, the following quote appeared in the Journal of Legal Education. Some of you may be familiar with it. It goes as follows. Lighthouse, him no good for fog. Lighthouse, him whistle, him blow, him ring bell, him flash light, him raise hell, but fog come in just the same. That's William Prosser. I think his comments are most appropriate for the topic that we have to discuss this morning, or this afternoon, rather, and indicate the position that many of us perhaps feel that we've labored in over the years, whether it be 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, or however long a period of time. The first thing that I want to do this afternoon is to try to very briefly outline the scope of this afternoon's topic and what we mean by legal research, legal writing, and perhaps what is not meant. First of all, I believe most of us can agree that instruction in legal research relates to the teaching of the mechanics of using legal source materials, and that probably by legal writing we mean the application of the knowledge that we have located in the legal sources in an effort to solve some type of legal problem, or putting our written report in a legal setting. I believe in most cases we probably, when we're talking about a course in legal writing, we are probably not usually talking about a course in remedial English, although that is an issue which is debated among some of our colleagues and perhaps may not be a valid observation. Lastly, I believe that by legal research, we do not mean research in the sense that the social scientists may understand it, or the physical scientists may understand it, that is, research in empirical data. That might be research about the law, but it's not research in the sources of the law. And so I believe the scope then of today's discussion probably relates to instruction in the use of legal source materials, and then the application of those located sources in a written context. In preparation for this presentation this afternoon, I did a fair amount of background reading, and one of the things which struck me, and perhaps it may be of some interest to you, is what appears in the legal periodical literature concerning research and writing courses. Prior to 1946, there was absolutely nothing in the Index to Legal Periodicals dealing with legal research and writing as an identified topic. There may have been articles that considered law school curricula, but they did not specifically address themselves to research and writing as such. And I believe the first of a long series of articles that began to appeared in 1948 in the Journal of Legal Education. Prior thereto, there was little, if anything, and I can say categorically that nothing showed up in the Index to Legal Periodicals. From 1948 until 1964, there was just a mass of literature appearing in especially the Journal of Legal Education, but also in other periodicals of interest to us. And in my comments, I'll refer to some of the comments, although not the articles by name. The bulk of the literature on the topic, however, appeared between 1948 and 1964. Then there was a gap during which time not little, if anything, appeared until 1973 and 1974. And at that time, there were a series of articles. I'm thinking primarily of the articles that Marjorie Rambaugh wrote and several other people, many of whom may be in the audience today. There were some four or five articles in the 1974-75 period. Those comments relate to the content of the literature. Some general remarks concerning the treatment of either legal research or legal research and writing or legal bibliography in law school curricula. There's a recent study by G. and Jackson called Following the Leader, the Unexamined Consensus in Law School Curricula, which just came across my desk about the week that I was drafted for this. According to G. and Jackson, legal research and writing or legal bibliography did not appear in law school catalogs prior to 1949. Now, I'm not sure how valid an observation that is, because the study that they were using, they examined actual catalogs covering the period 1949-50, but for the period prior thereto, they made use of other studies, which in turn had used some other studies, so you had hearsay several times removed. And all that they could can be gleaned from their materials for the period prior to 1949 is that it was not required at Harvard in 1832, nor in 1879, nor in 1916. And I think it's still true that it is not required at Harvard. In 1949-50, of some 100 law school catalogs studied, a course called Legal Bibliography was required by 55% of the schools, and it generally consisted of a one-semester-hour course, and apparently there were no specifically identified legal writing courses. Now, that's inconsistent with a couple of the journal articles, some of which I'll refer to in a minute, but generally speaking, by 1950, what we're talking about is a legal bibliography course and nothing beyond that. By 1969-70, things had changed, and by that time, the course being required was a legal research and writing course, and of some 60 catalogs studied by G. and Jackson, there were 70% of the law schools requiring a course on legal research and writing. In addition to those, that 70% requiring a research and writing course, some 52% required a course in legal method. Lastly, in 1974-75, some 108 schools out of 127, that is 85%, required a course in legal research and writing. 46% required a legal method course. And generally speaking, the research and writing courses consisted of two semester hours. An informal study run in my own library during the past month showed that approximately the same figures, a similar number of law schools required a research and writing course as that which was found by G. and Jackson. Strangely, or perhaps not so strangely, and this may be indicative of what happens in legal education, the schools which one might rate higher using Charles Kelso's scale of financial support for law schools as determining the so-called better law schools, it seems that the schools which had the better position in terms of financial support tended generally not to require, certainly not to require, a legal research course, and perhaps something along those lines can be said as to a legal writing course. I'm not sure that the last observation is 100% valid. Let me turn next to what I believe are some of the staffing patterns that have developed over the years, both based on personal observation and some consideration of the literature. many of us, when we went through law school, the only staffing pattern that existed was that someone taught a course in legal bibliography, and perhaps if one were fortunate, there was some sort of a writing requirement other than searching and finding out an objective answer type problem. So one typical pattern that I assume, that I hope is no longer prevalent, was a sole faculty member teaching a course in basic legal bibliography. Several other patterns developed, the most noteworthy of which perhaps started the process, was a pattern developed at the University of Chicago, which was written up by Professor Calvin in 1948. And under that pattern, which has been followed by a number of other schools, the staffing of the program consisted of one so-called regular faculty member assisted by two or more teaching fellows. At the University of Chicago in 1948, it consisted of four fellows. Harvard has a similar pattern. In the 1950s, Northwestern has a similar pattern, but based on the outline of my colleague here, it looks as if that pattern has changed a slight bit. Another pattern was developed at the University of Wisconsin. Macaulay and Manny have an article in the Journal of Legal Education describing what they developed at that school. That staffing pattern consisted of having one regular full-time faculty member being the coordinator of the program, and that faculty member assisted by numerous, usually third-year, better quality law students. So you had a pattern of regular faculty members assisted in the direct contact with the first-year students, assisted by third-year law students, so teaching assistants and a faculty member. A further pattern that was written up in the literature is a pattern followed at, among other places, by Vanderbilt University and written up by Covington in 1964, in which, I suppose for cost considerations or perhaps others, they developed the pattern of assigning the research and writing program to all members of the law school faculty, that burden being shared equally by all members, one member of the faculty being the person responsible for coordinating the instructional process. And then lastly, there is a pattern whereby a full-time faculty member worked with a number of part-time faculty, usually recent graduates of the law school or recent graduates of some good quality school. And I believe that pattern has been followed by Minnesota, and I believe was written up in the journal describing the Rutgers program back in the 50s. Those are the principal patterns, instructional patterns, which seem to have developed over the years and which I believe are probably still being implemented by our schools in one way or another, or in one combination or another. Let me move next on to some observations concerning course objectives and goals. The first article that I located concerning research and writing was an article by William Rolfe at Northwestern, and his article dealt with the program then existent at that school. The program then existent at Northwestern was basically, as I interpret his comments, a legal bibliography course. And so prior to the development of the 50s, the legal bibliography was the sole emphasis given to in our area. Then, beginning in the 50s, the emphasis tended, generally speaking, to be placed on the writing aspects of the program, and in addition, in many schools, to the legal method portion of first-year coursework that should be emphasized. The prime example, I think, is the program developed at the University of Chicago by Professor Calvin. A second example that perhaps is worth mentioning now is the program developed at Northwestern The reason I refer to the two is that for purposes of the writing emphasis, the thrust of the party's writing on the topic was that at Chicago they felt that certain things could not be taught. For instance, Calvin says that you cannot teach writing. I think that's, I'm not misquoting him, but that you could do so only indirectly. The Chicago people took the position that the types of projects that the students should engage on should be a limited number of extensive research and writing type projects. The Northwestern people at that time seemed to take a different approach and say that, and said that no, there should be more but shorter types of assignments culminating in an extensive writing writing exercise. And so you had from the very beginning two schools taking a different approach to the question of what type of writing exercises should the first-year students engage in. The Chicago and the Harvard people tended, at least in their reported statements, to add on top of that the goal to give further background in the area of the legal process, so that much of the writing assignments in the Chicago and Harvard model seem to revolve not solely around the typical law office memorandum or the appellate brief, but also to revolve around political issues, the policy type issues. They gave assignments in writing editorial type comments on particular points of law. They tried to enlarge the horizons, I suppose, of their students. So you basically had two approaches in terms of course objectives and goals that seemed to develop in the literature and, I suppose, in practice, namely where the principal emphasis in the writing aspect was on using the typical types of lawyer writing, a memorandum, a brief, and those which went beyond those narrower fields to try to enlarge the horizons of the student, to try to have the student develop a better grasp of the legal process. Now, I think that probably outlines the general background that one should be aware of, at least to discuss, so that we can intelligently discuss the question of methods of organizing legal research and writing courses. What I'd like to do now is focus in on the types of questions that I believe each of us has been facing in our own work in our law schools, in which and which each of our faculties must face in our law schools today, tomorrow, and in the years ahead. First of all, I believe, and this came true, this clearly seemed to have been felt by everyone who wrote on the topic, I believe that the principal consideration affecting what is done or is not done in the program is one of staffing, i.e., that of cost. And it clearly was the determining factor which caused a Wisconsin to follow the route that it took and a Kentucky to follow a slight variation on the theme and some other school to follow a third variation on the theme. And so cost here is a prime determinant for staffing of the program, for determining whether it should be, the whole program should be developed and taught by full-time faculty solely, or whether it should be taught by a teaching fellows coordinated by a full-time faculty member, or by teaching assistants coordinated by a full-time faculty member, or by part-time instructors, or some combination of all of the above. So staffing and the cost of staffing, I believe, are the primary determinants that bring about a resolution of all of the other issues that one has to consider. Probably the next consideration, although it's, I think, not the consideration of greatest interest to students, or at least not the consideration that causes the most student unrest, the next consideration, I think, is what shall be the course content. In talking about the development of the course, I glossed over what happened to legal bibliography or legal research instruction over the period of time, the 10 or 15 years beginning in 1948 and ending in 1964 and continuing to the present. But I think that has to be considered. Should legal research, legal bibliography, whatever one wishes to call it, be a discrete component of a research and writing course? Should there be separate lectures? What types of exercises should be imposed upon the students in order to either demonstrate to the instructor competence or in order to force the students into the libraries to develop some competence? The only reason for is to develop ability, and the only question is, what is the base, the most effective basis for to achieve that ability? But the bulk of the courses that were written up in the Journal of Legal Education seemed, generally speaking, to de-emphasize instruction in certainly legal bibliography, if that's something different from legal research, and perhaps even to de-emphasize instruction in legal research. It seemed to be sort of an afterthought, and one which, because of my own biases and backgrounds, I'm not sure that I agree with. But it clearly is an issue which each of us has to hassle with. The other question concerns the relationship between a course in legal writing and a course in remedial writing. All the way back in 1954, there was at least one article dealing with remedial writing for minority students. The only other article of literature was one appearing in 1973, where the author took the position, which I think I agree with almost completely. The problem is not one peculiar to minority students, but it's a problem where it exists that's true of perhaps all law students. I'm not sure if the problem is one of writing myself or whether it's one of thinking logically and reasoning logically and precisely and succinctly and then putting that succinct reasoning into writing. And sometimes I find that the difficulty is more with the relatively poor level of reasoning that is brought to bear, more so than the or lack thereof. But one, we do have to consider the question, should the course be a course in remedial writing, or is it one be a course in so-called legal writing? Another question which is of lesser moment for me is appellate advocacy, written and oral, be a part of the course. Then the last question probably is, to what extent, if at all, should legal method be a part of the course? Now, a last that I would like to raise this afternoon is this. It relates to the status of the course. The answer to this is not completely clear from the literature, although a superficial examination of current catalogs suggests one general direction. The question is this: status of the course. Should the course be a required course? And I think since we are talking about a first-year course, probably it's reasonable to assume that it will be a required course, although it is not so specified in all of the catalogs considered by me, nor was it so specified by the materials that G. and Jackson considered. Assuming it is a required course, the far more important question, certainly for students, and the one which causes a great deal of hassle among all students is, should it be given for credit or not? When I first went to Florida State University, there was no course in legal research and writing whatsoever, and the course, I had to teach a course in, I don't know what it was called, but I taught a course, and it ended up being a course in research and writing. And it was a required course, but no credit was offered. So the first complaint that year was it should be for credit. There weren't complaints about the excessive work because no one had had a course prior thereto, and so that was the most successful I'd ever had with it. But the question was one of credit, and then the question that follows, if it is for credit, what shall be the amount of credit awarded? The level of credit awarded at the various schools has varied anywhere from 0 hours of credit to 8 hours of credit awarded by the University of Chicago, which is perhaps interesting. That was 8 hours of credit based on an academic year of 40 hours. So it's not quite a quarter system, but nor was it a semester system. So should it be for credit or not? Then, once we had gotten over the hurdle of having the course not only required but for credit at our own institution, the following question arose: should it be a pass-fail course or should it be a graded course? Now, the reported, the various courses that have been written up in the journal, there are as many variations almost as there were schools being written up. In our own institution, it was not graded with numbers initially. I felt very strongly that I would have a great deal more leverage if the course were a graded course, and in two successive years we went from an ungraded pass-fail course to a graded course, and I had some of the same teaching assistants helping me with it, and based on their impressions, these were students, there were very strong feelings that a graded course brought more work out of the first-year students working in the program. But that is an issue that had to be faced. The very next year, after we had gone to a graded course, the objection was that we were being graded by peers, and it's not appropriate to be graded by students, and therefore it should not be graded, so that right now we're back on the reverse end of the cycle, and it's no longer graded. But I believe the pass-fail versus graded course is an issue that has to be faced very clearly. Those are the concerns that I believe we should consider, namely, how shall the course be staffed? What shall be the course content? What is the status of the course, graded, required, the like? I'd like to, if you can bear with me for a few minutes, read some excerpts from a report on a recent legal writing course. It says, the course in legal writing was required for first-year students. So-and-so was the faculty director. He and another faculty member each instructed 5 students in order to maintain faculty contact with the program and to keep the load on the teaching fellows to below 25 first-year students each. The first of the 2 projects assigned during the fall quarter was an analysis of a given series of Supreme Court cases totaling about 330 pages. The project required no research. Citations to all the required cases were furnished to the students. 2 drafts of the analysis were submitted, with an individual interview scheduled for discussion of each. About 8 days were allowed for the first draft and 5 for the second. It says, the project was unsatisfactory in 2 respects. There was too much case material required. The second difficulty arose from the fact that the written instructions were not sufficiently definite in their requirements. The second problem was a research memorandum on a given factual situation. 7 different problems were used for a class of 55. In general, the problems seemed to have been appropriate for their purpose. The staff attempted to determine in advance which were the more difficult problems. With 3 or 4 exceptions, the final drafts were readable and understandable. The outlines, however, were generally poor. They required outlines before a final draft be turned in, and sketchy because of a lack of definite requirements in the instructions and because of the fact that they were not graded. As an experiment, the staff proposed to include with the second project, and perhaps also with the third, seminars composed of the students working on the same problems. Closely associated with the problem of scheduling is the problem of student load per staff member. 25 students per staff member seems to be the maximum. It would probably be a waste of personnel to assign fewer than 20 students per full-time staff member. Individual work by staff members on papers, both written and by way of oral criticism in the interview, is the core of the course. In general, the greater reliance should be placed upon written criticism rather than oral criticism. That criticism is likely to be clearer and more carefully weighed if the instructor has to formulate it in writing, although that's a very time-consuming task. At the beginning of the course, there was discussion as to whether the individual papers should be graded. It was decided to give grades. The eagerness evinced by the students to get their grades suggests that this decision was correct. The final grades averaged 72.6 on the scale. This was higher than the norm for that class. The standards of grading necessarily were vague and subjective. Grading was complicated, especially by the second project, by the fact that the students were working on different problems, lack of uniformity among the various instructors, on different problems of different degrees of difficulty. If the average grades seem high, it is probably due in part to the extra weight given by the staff to the final draft of the second project, which in some cases was better than the first. I could go on. Perhaps I should jump down to the concluding paragraph. Nevertheless, certain arguments favor offering the course again in the second year. The question now is, when should the course be offered? Should it be a first-year course when you have all of your entering class, or should it be a second-year course? Certain arguments favor offering the course in the second year. By the second year, students have learned to study faster and have more time available. The class is reduced by one-third to one-half by elimination of those working on the law review and those who have left the school for whatever reasons. Second-year students may be more sophisticated. On the other hand, there are several persuasive arguments in favor of giving the course in the first year. The prospect of elimination of low-average students at the end of the year would increase incentive to do the hard work involved in legal writing. A measure other than test grades could be available in deciding upon students to be eliminated at the end of the first year. Students would integrate with their formal classwork from the beginning of their training the broader view of the techniques of the law learned in legal writing. A valuable indication of good law review material would be provided. Actually, this isn't a recent report. It's a report that was given to me by one of my instructors over 10 years ago when I was a law student, and he had acquired it when he was a visiting faculty member at Stanford in 1948. So I would conclude with my opening remark that lighthouse him no good for fog, lighthouse him whistle, him blow, him ring bell, him flash light, him raise hell, but fog come in just the same.
Thank you very much, Ed. I think, thank you a lot, Ed, and now I guess we'll throw it open to individual questions. Julius?
I'd like to suggest that there is another basic question that might be addressed to this group. I thought your questions were well reasoned out and very pertinent to what should be discussed here today. And that is, what is the end product that you're getting as a result of all these variables of course content, the status, set, patterns of teaching, course? Are we getting a better end product to the student? Is the end result
I assume that your comments don't expect a reply.
Yes, I do. No, I appreciate that. No, this is what really bothers me. I've read a lot of that literature, too. And everything you say is very true, very up. I think you put up all the real problems that exist today. But what do we prove by? This is the problem. Are we really getting a better student for reason of teaching this way or teaching that way? And perhaps the poorest course with the very best students would end up with the same sort of qualified students as in any other school with good students, getting even a better program.
I would add one comment on that. The Carrington Report, and I failed to refer to that today, the Carrington Report does not assume a course, a separate discrete course in research and writing. In neither of its three categories of instruction, basic, intensive, or extensive, it assumes courses in a particular substantive area in which there would be a very low student-faculty ratio and extensive research and writing, and research, not merely research in law sources, but researches about law sources too, I would assume. And it assumes that type of a program rather than a distinct research and writing course.
In other words, is the research and writing course really an attempt on the part of the regular faculty teaching the regular course to advocate the role that they should really play in their own course?
Well, of course, that goes to a further question, too, of student-faculty ratios for the whole law school, where law schools are at a severe detriment in vis-a-vis our counterparts in other graduate programs. The student-faculty ratios there would never be tolerated at the level that we have to.
Any more questions to Ed, gentlemen?
Fails to force the student into using those skills, then all of the effort of the first year will be lost, and it may be that that's part of the problem that you're alluding to. I know in my own school it's possible for someone to get through the curriculum with having to do but very little by way of of research and writing in substantive courses. And that's a defect in our school, and it's probably a defect in many schools. And that is maybe one reason for the problem that you referred to. Would you restate again your second question? Yeah.
Is there, or has anybody a real distinction between them? Are they the same? Should they be the same?
I'm not sure that I'm qualified to answer to that. The impression that I have from... I think there may be some difference in the way in which people view the two. And that's both from what I've experienced over the last 10 years and what I've read recently on the topic. But I'm not sure that I could verbalize the difference, if any. Perhaps someone more qualified in the audience might be able to shed some light on that. It may be that bibliography relates more to what those of us who are also librarians tend to get into, and that research in the sense of the skills that a student should develop in order to use a law collection need not have the same degree of specificity as perhaps might be necessary for a person who is working qua librarian. No. Now, there's one other place where I think courses on research and writing limp very greatly. I know ours do. And we do a decent job, I think, in conveying the basic information that law students should acquire to use basic types of legal of law books. But what we do a very poor job on, and this year with the variation we're trying to overcome that, although I'm not involved in this, we do a very poor job in tying together everything that has been handed out in pieces. And I don't know whether one can teach that. Perhaps this is one of the places where Calvin and the Chicago people are right, that you can't teach it. You have to develop the expertise by doing it. But I know that the constant student complaints are that we don't tie things together.
I think we're going to have to move along here, and I think Ed has done a very excellent job of presenting his paper and also of answering questions, but I'm afraid that time, we'll just have to move along and go to some of the other speakers. Thank you an awful lot, Ed, and thank you for members of the audience who were participating. I think in view of the fact that Ed did allude to the program at Northwestern University, I think that instead of calling on Raymond as the next speaker, I think it'd be a good idea if we called at Mr. Freed from Northwestern to give his paper.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I'm not sure that the program that we have now bears much relationship to the program you described. What I plan to do is simply outline the nature of our program, Northwestern program, as it exists in the current year, and then to raise some of the questions which have occurred to us in administering this program this year. Now, I only this year come to be involved in the writing, so I'm certainly comforted to note that these questions have arisen for far more years than I've been involved in, and no doubt will continue to be debated. Our program is administered in a variant or a hybrid of two of the approaches that Ed was describing. We have two full faculty directors of the program who have overall responsibility, but not day-to-day supervision of the operation of the program. I'm one, and as another, and they tend to be junior faculty. And then we have a lecturer in legal writing who is a recent law graduate and has tended for quite a number of years, with one or two exceptions, to be a graduate of an English university, Oxford recently and this year Cambridge. And that person, the lecturer in legal writing, has day-to-day responsibility for the administration of the program and is responsible for conducting one legal writing meeting. We also have 13 as of this year senior law students termed assistants in instruction or compensated, and each of them is responsible for one legal writing group. So we have a total of 14 legal writing groups for a student body of approximately 175 to 180, working out to an average of about 15 to 16 per group, 14 to 15 per group. Now our curriculum is in both semesters, both the semesters of the first year, it is a required course. And in the fall semester, we have the groups required to meet weekly for an hour. And the fall semester is ungraded. Our entire first semester of law school is ungraded. And the participation in legal writing in the fall semester is ungraded, but there's no course grade. What we've done is to carry over the credit for the time spent in the first semester into the second semester graded work, so that we have 3 hours of graded work in the spring, composed of 2 hours of credit for work that students did in the fall and 1 hour of credit for new course in the spring. Our program begins during our orientation period with an exercise in briefing cases. We have a canned set of four cases, which are distributed in two installments to the legal writing groups. They are the notion of briefing cases is explained to them, they do the exercise, they bring it back, and hand it into the legal writing instructor, and there is class discussion on it. The second, chronologically, the second aspect of the legal writing program is a library tour and library exercise. We have staff of the library who are available to give lectures to legal writing groups. And our legal writing instructors participate in that information imparting exercise. And then we have a library exercise which has varied considerably over the years from a very substantial and lengthy kind of exercise, really an exercise in just finding the books, to one that this year was somewhat less oppressive, but which got the students to the major kinds of books which they would be required to use for basic legal research. The bulk or the guts of the first semester legal writing program consists of legal memoranda, research memoranda. And I suppose Northwestern still adheres to the position that you do shorter problems but more of them to kind of build experientially the kinds of skills that are required, although this year, and for the past few years, we've had fewer problems than in probably the time that you were discussing it. We have four legal memoranda at present, the first of which is purely a writing exercise. We have, again, a canned problem with cases, statutes, and a fact situation. And the students are asked to do a legal memorandum without doing any outside research, simply to get the format of a legal memorandum, the conventions involved in drafting a legal memorandum. And that, this past year was the first assignment, and they were given 3 weeks for it, which I suspect was probably too long given the difficulty of the first assignment. The second and third memoranda are research memoranda devised individually by the legal writing instructors. And
we encourage legal writing instructors to be independent in their development of research problems, but the lecturer in legal writing is ultimately responsible for the oversight of devising these problems, and the student instructors are required to get approval from the lecturer as to the content of these problems. And they're encouraged to develop problems that will which will require the use of diverse legal materials to, again, acquaint the students with a variety of bibliographical materials. The final memorandum is a memorandum which is linked with our moot court program in the spring. We have a memorandum exercise in the spring, and then the students do the same problem for one party or the other in a brief writing in the fall. And they do the same problem in a brief writing exercise in the spring semester. What we've done this year is to pair legal writing groups so that we have six moot court problems which are used by the students in their legal writing groups in the first semester. And we've tried to take these cases, we give them a record. We try possible to get records of real cases, and we work very closely with the Legal Assistance Clinic in coming up with cases which are pending in the clinic and for which peripherally we can do some work for the clinic and aid them in their work. That is the writing component of the first semester. We also have a legal method or reasoning component, which consists of some readings which we distribute, both readings prepared by the lecturer and this year Levy's Introduction to Legal Reasoning. I guess I should say here that one of the things that that we found this year in working with the curriculum of the legal writing program is that there has been a tendency in the past couple of years to load up the content of the legal writing program, to increase the kinds of curricular items that we bring in to the legal writing program, to some extent, I suppose, to reflect the peculiarities or the predilections of the people running the program at the time as to what needs to be done that isn't being done elsewhere in the first year curriculum. I happen to be, and the person, the lecturer in law last year, was a strong believer in the notion of a legal methods or legal reasoning course. Now, we don't have a course like that. And so we bring in some materials to do legal reasoning to try and focus on those issues which are not dealt with in a systematic way, although they're dealt with interstitially in the substantive courses of the first year. Similarly, Northwestern is, I suppose, in the minority of schools that don't have a first-year civil procedure required course. And that's a subject of great debate among the faculty. And one of the things that we find is that we bring in elements of civil procedure materials into the legal writing program to get the students familiarized with those, with the basics of procedure, so that they can better work with the case materials in their substantive courses. And we've done that this year by bringing in Franklin's biography of a legal dispute and having discussion groups with a variety of members of the faculty on various aspects of civil procedure. That's the content of the first semester. In the spring semester, we carry over, as I said before, the moot court problem, which was used as a memorandum problem in the first semester, and it's briefed by the students. Each student is required to write a brief on one side, but then the students are paired in twos for purposes of oral argument. They're paired, one person having written an appellant brief, one person having written an appellee brief, and then they argue as teams twice, one on the side of the appellants and one on the side of the appellees. So each student has an experience arguing once on his or her own brief and one's off brief. Now, that's a basic outline of the program. Let me just outline some of the questions that we've raised in trying to administer the program, and to some extent it is repetitious of what Ed said. One of the major problems, obviously, is staffing. Northwestern at one time did have a group of associates or instructors in legal writing, numbering four or so. And at some time in the recent past, we moved to the notion of having one full-time person and student instructorships. There are fiscal considerations, obviously, that bear on that matter, and it raises some problems. There's the difficulty of selection of students. I'm personally coming to the conclusion that above a certain fairly high level of academic attainment, the qualifications for student instructors in legal writing are much more of a personal and sensitivity nature than they are of an intellectual nature. I think we've found that there can be personality conflicts when you're dealing with student instructors who start off, I suppose, with some kind of disadvantage in terms of being put in a position to grade and a position of authority with relation to their peers. It's important to try and get people where the personality problems won't be very serious. And I think one of the things that we're toying with for our interviews of third-year students next year is to try and come up with some questions or hypothetical situations which we can standardize in the interviewing process to get a sense of the way these third-year students would react to real situations that come up in the legal writing program. Another problem with student instructorships is not peculiar to students, but to the number of instructors that you then have, and that's the difficulty of supervision. We've got 13 groups, and the lecturer in legal writing, in addition to substantial administrative tasks, especially in connection with organizing the moot court program, which is an arduous task indeed, the lecturer has to supervise these 13 legal writing groups and legal writing instructors. And to some extent, it is difficult to have a day-to-day handle on what's going on in these groups. You depend all too much, I think, on feedback from students in the groups, which tends to be the complaints. And so you find yourself in a position of hearing negatives and not too many positives and not really knowing what is going on. You're kind of at a loss to know how to evaluate the one or two students from each group who come in and complain about their experience. It may be inevitable, but there's no way to judge that. Another thing that we've confronted with the student instructorships is the notion of time. Taking on a legal writing group can be, if it's to be done responsibly and effectively, is a very time-consuming job. We've opted in the past for a plan where the students are paid. That, I suppose, relieves some time pressure for students who would otherwise have to get outside of law school jobs. But it still means that these senior law students have to take a full semester's work in other coursework. And we've been discussing, and we will be considering, I think, for next year, the question of whether it isn't more efficient in terms of the operation of the legal writing program that the student instructors receive course credit instead of compensation. And one further advantage to something like that would be that we could more reasonably require an ongoing kind of seminar for our student instructors, which I think would have very substantial beneficial effects to their teaching effectiveness in the various groups. Now, course content is an obvious dilemma. As I indicated, there is a tendency, I think, I would imagine universally, to try to do too much in legal writing. It's an opportunity at many law schools to get students in a small group situation, and that's unique. It's an opportunity to do intensive work, which in the first year is usually absent, other intensive in the sense of very pressured kind of writing where people have to operate effectively under time constraints and turn out a product, which would then be critiqued very, very severely. So we tend to bring a lot of things into it. And as I see it, the four elements of curricular